supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Last weekend's violent clashes between white supremacists and counter-protesters in Virginia began because of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. The statue was set to be removed following criticism that it glorified the history of racism and slavery of the South. Now, a statue in Philadelphia is facing criticism of its own. It's the bronze sculpture of former Philadelphia Mayor and Police Commissioner Frank Rizzo, known for his harsh tactics against African Americans. WHYY's Joe Hernandez spoke with the man who created the Rizzo statue in the mid-1990s.
Zenos Fridakis moved from Gary, Indiana to Philadelphia in the late 70s. Rizzo was mayor by then, having earned a reputation as a law and order police commissioner in the late 60s and early 70s. Fridakis was a young liberal artist when he was commissioned to sculpt the controversial city figure.
Should I have said no? I mean, I just got out of art school. I needed to make a living.
The 10-foot bronze statue, which sits outside City Hall, shows a striding, triumphant-looking Rizzo. He was modeled on images of Augustus Caesar. But now Fridakis is left wondering whether the sculpture he spent 5 years creating will become a footnote. Critics are calling for its removal, saying Rizzo's law and order policies came at the expense of African Americans who were brutalized by city police. Fridakis says those are valid criticisms, but adds there's more to Rizzo's legacy.
It's a little complicated. It's not all black and white. You know, there's a lot of gray here.
He notes that Philadelphians elected Rizzo twice as mayor, and Fridakis says he was nothing like the Confederate generals whose monuments are toppling across the country. Still, the sculptor says residents ought to decide whether Rizzo stays or goes.
Should he be front and center across from City Hall? Well, that's something people should talk about. I can understand that. If the majority would prefer to see him somewhere else, maybe a nice park somewhere in South Philly or somewhere else, that's something, let's talk about it. Let's decide it and consider moving it, and maybe somebody can be put in his place.
Fridakis says there's a third option. Keep the sculpture, but update it so that people can learn more about Rizzo's tenure.
You can put up a plaque that says something about the differences that people had with him, and that he was controversial and so on. You know, make it a piece of education. If you remove it, the education is gone.
Pretty soon, it may be gone. Mayor Jim Kenney now says it's time for a conversation about the Rizzo statue, and several city council members say it has to go. For WHYY, I'm Joe Hernandez.
Marriage to a United States citizen is one of the only ways an immigrant in the country illegally can get a green card. And before this year, immigration officers would generally leave those on that path to legal status alone, as long as they didn't have a criminal record. Now, WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that some coming out of the shadows as spouses of U.S. citizens are winding up in jail.
Marriage tests couples in any number of ways. Lily Williams and Jonathan Palacios, both in their late 20s, have just spent about an hour getting quizzed, literally, on their relationship. Standing outside a gray federal building in West Philadelphia, they say U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services ask them everything from the date they were married to the name of their cat.
Even though I know everything, for some reason I got in the interview and I couldn't remember any of the dates. So, like, I usually get mad at him for not knowing the dates.
Williams and Palacios have been together for 7 years and married for 2. Palacios is undocumented. He left Honduras when he was 16 and crossed the border illegally. Late last year, they began the process of bringing him out of the shadows, filing what's called a petition for an alien relative. This interview is one of their last steps to getting it approved. Pulling out a fat blue accordion folder, Williams leafs through all the evidence they brought.
This is like our tickets from our honeymoon, from like the hotel and everything.
Then she comes across a stack of stationery.
Yeah, these are letters I sent to him while I was in New York.
She's talking about a prison in York County that also houses immigrants the federal government is planning to deport. One morning in early May, immigration officers showed up outside the couple's home in Haverford, around the time Palacios goes to work at a restaurant. They surrounded his car and arrested him. It's not clear how Immigration and Customs Enforcement found him. ICE declined an interview, but a spokesman said in a statement that the office does sometimes get information from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. That's the part of the federal government that processes immigration petitions. So far, arrests like Palacios are not a huge trend. WHYY has confirmed 3 cases with local ties where ICE arrested a person after they came forward as the spouse of a U.S. citizen. Compare that to the first 3 months of this year, when more than 1,000 people in Pennsylvania filed family petitions. But it is still a change, says William Stock, a local attorney and former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
Previously, if a person was filing that petition, it was very often the first step to getting themselves on the road back to legal. And the Immigration Service would very often look at that situation and say, well, look, I mean, if you're on the road to legal, let's not make you a priority.
But now, Stock says, immigration officers are obliged to arrest any undocumented person they come across under executive orders signed by President Donald Trump.
Does this person have a U.S. citizen relative? Does this person have U.S. citizen children? Does this person have a job or a business that they run? None of those things matter. Everyone is a priority for removal.
Palacios does have one black mark on his record that gives immigration authorities the right to deport him immediately. When he was 18, he missed a hearing with an immigration judge in Philadelphia. While that doesn't sound like a big deal, local immigration attorney Brennan John Grosso says it carries a stiff penalty under U.S. immigration law.
It's pretty unforgiving in the sense that you can't miss a court date in immigration court. If you miss a court date, you're ordered removed.
This April, one of John Grosso's clients found himself in nearly the same situation as Palacios. He reads some details from the man's file.
They got married in 2015, so he's been married for just over 2 years, and he has a son who is 2.5.
That man, who didn't give his attorney permission to use his name, also had missed an immigration hearing and is still in York County prison. John Grosso says this has not happened to one of his clients before, and it makes him pause. He says he would still advise future clients to try to fix their status, but to proceed with caution.
If you're going in with your eyes open, that's the most important thing, is really that the client is well informed about the risks.
Those risks now include potential arrest. Back in West Philadelphia, Palacios says spending 5 weeks in detention was really hard. He and Williams debated moving to Honduras just to free him. But he wanted to stick it out. And because Palacios has a good case to stay here as the spouse of a U.S. citizen, a judge released him in June. Now, he says, dealing with immigration is actually less scary.
It doesn't feel painful to do anything. It's like normal stuff. It's better than being where I was. So,
he was mad at me for being nervous because he was like, look, I went through a lot worse than this. We can take an interview.
After all, they've already weathered a much more difficult test when Palacios was behind bars. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
A group of local rugby clubs has spent the summer helping to spread the game to a new generation in Northeast Philadelphia. WHYY's J. Scott Smith reports that the sport is slowly finding a home with kids in the city's Frankfurt section.
On a hot Friday afternoon at the Northeast Frankfurt Boys and Girls Club, a group of kids goes through the finer points of rugby, one of the world's toughest sports. Or at least, that's the plan.
Here you go.
We're going to play tag, I promise, but we got to do some of the fundamentals first. We've got to be good teammates. Good catch.
The summer rugby program is a joint venture of the Schuylkill River RFC, Philadelphia Women's RFC, and the North Philly Nomads RFC. It's geared toward kids in the largely African-American Frankfurt neighborhood. Dave Cadell is the president of the Schuylkill River Club, and he helps coach the Narberth Otters Youth Rugby Club. He sees the program as a way to help grow the game.
It was an opportunity for us to give back to our community and find an area that's maybe overlooked a little bit, you know, the Northeast Frankfurt area and these kids in general, and come in and just, you know, be positive role models and everything else, and, you know, provide some programming for them.
Now, on this particular day, the kids, some as young as 5, are learning how to pass the ball and work together as a team. Rugby is often compared to football because of the running, catching, and tackling. But the coaches also compare it to basketball, with its focus on quick, lateral passing. Cadell says the 10-week program gets more in-depth with the older kids, but he's happy to be able to do what he can for the youngsters. Nomad's coach and founder James Brunson, also known as JB, says the program is all about helping the kids experience a new sport.
When I first started the North Philadelphia Nomads, when we started playing other schools and other teams, majority of them were suburban teams, 90 minutes or so out. And we'll step off the bus, and it'll be like the first time I ever played an all-black team.
Brunson spent this day leading drills around the gym, along with help from women's coach Kate Halliman. Some of the smaller kids struggled at first with passing the ball before they finally got their groove going. Brunson says all he wants to see is continued growth from the kids. The club anticipates that as many as 130 kids will participate in this program, and it's expanding playing time to 40 hours a week for the rest of the summer. And that's just fine with Cadell, who raves about the chance to interact with the young players and share his love of rugby.
Man, I'll tell you, I like working with kids. I like being a role model. I grew up in Villanova, man. I had a lot of privileges. Let's call it what it is. A lot of luck, a lot of good fortune, man. So to try to pay it forward, you know, to these guys, and to see it working, to see them happy, see them, you know, enjoying rugby and having a good time, it's like the best feeling in the world.
For WHYY News.
You guys ready?
Yeah. I'm Jay Scott Smith.
The American shad once swam freely up rivers from Florida to Maine each spring. Then pollution, overfishing, and dams forced shad to retreat from the Delaware River watershed. This spring, experts say they're seeing the largest shad run in decades, and it turns out the fish are swimming even farther upriver to smaller tributaries in places they haven't appeared in centuries. State Impact Pennsylvania's Catalina Jaramillo reports on how dam removal efforts are paying off.
Pat Hamilton remembers the moment well.
I first caught a glimpse of them, and I was wondering, I said, that looks like a shad. I think that's a shad. I hope that's a shad. And I started feverishly casting in that direction.
It was on a sunny morning, early in June, right here at the Musconetcong River, nicknamed the Muskie. It's a tributary of the Delaware River in northwestern New Jersey. Hamilton is a fisheries biologist with the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. We're walking on the banks of the river, among trees and rocks. It's green and remote, and there's not a house in sight. Hamilton points to the exact spot where she found the first American shad sighted in this river since colonial times.
It was just over by that rock on the other side of those bushes.
Shad is a large type of herring that can weigh from 4 to 8 pounds. They're a prized game fish for anglers, and shad roe, which are the fish eggs, are considered a delicacy. They swim up the Delaware to spawn every spring, but they've never made it to the Muskie until now.
It swam down to a rock down there and then came up, almost got wrapped around a log out there, but I did manage to land it here.
Hamilton says having that large shad in her hands was the most thrilling moment in her career. The return of the shad to the Muskie symbolizes the success of a long river restoration process, and the key to that success was getting rid of the dams. Alan Hunt, director of the Musconetcong Watershed Association, points to a map that shows which dams have already been removed.
Regalsville and then Finesville. Hughesville is the one we just took out.
The Watershed Association has been removing dams in partnership with state and federal authorities for nearly a decade, and there's still 20 dams to go. Shad and other migratory fish cannot jump over dams. But last September, the large Hughesville Dam was removed, opening 6 miles of free-flowing river. It cost about $2 million, but Hamilton says they were really surprised by the fast payoff.
It tells quite a story in that as soon as you remove a dam, at least on this river, the shad, the next opportunity, are right there.
But there are still about 1,700 regulated dams in New Jersey, all of them higher than 5 feet tall. The first dams were built by European settlers to power mills. Bigger manufacturers created larger dams, and then developers built them to create lakes to sell more suburban houses. Some locals don't want to lose their favorite swimming spots, but Hamilton says dams create unhealthy rivers because the artificial barriers stop the natural flow, making sediments accumulate and the water warmer.
Environmentally, they alter the ecosystem, but they're also a hazard for humans.
Dams are expensive to maintain, and they are a liability. Swimming near them is dangerous, and they could exacerbate flooding. Hunt from the Musconetcong Watershed Association says removing dams is also good for tourism. It transforms still and warm ponds into more exciting, fast-moving waters for kayaking and fishing.
We don't have the need anymore for those structures, but we do have a need for recreation.
And he says it could mean that other migratory fish, like trout, which also prefer fast currents and shallow waters, will return to the Muskie. Next on the list to go is the Warren Glen Dam. It's up north from the spot Hamilton found the first shad. The dam is 30 feet high, and it looks like a big artificial waterfall. Looking from the top of it, it's easy to see how there's no way shad can swim up here. But removing it will open another 5 miles of free-flowing river for migratory fish.
It'll be amazing. It'll be an amazing transformation. But it doesn't happen overnight.
It will take at least 3 more years. By then, hopefully the baby shads, born here this summer, will be coming back to spawn. Catalina Jaramillo, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The challenge of writing a brief history of Philadelphia falls to one Roger Simon, professor of history at Lehigh University. He joins me now on Newsworks Tonight. Roger, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So this is a challenge indeed. The book is 121 pages, plus several annotations and charts and graphs. But how does one go about going all the way back from 1682 to pretty much the present? How did you prioritize what to put in, what to leave out?
Yeah, it was the hard part. It was the hard part. And a lot of prioritization, like you suggest, stuck to several themes, had to leave a lot of things out. That's about the only way you can do it.
Of course, any history of Pennsylvania and Philadelphia starts with one William Penn.
Right.
And it's interesting. King Charles II despised Quakers, but he owed Billy's dad a favor.
That's correct. William Penn's father had been helpful in Charles II's restoration to the throne, and he owed him money, and he had no money, and that debt kind of dragged on for a while, and William Penn had kind of converted to Quakerism. His father was not a Quaker, and had this idea of planting a colony. And it was a way for the crown to get rid of some Quakers and to get rid of the debt. Because, you know, what did it cost them to give away Pennsylvania? It was a wilderness.
That plan specifically for Philadelphia was a quadrant system.
Exactly.
And with center squares.
That was Penn's plan. Setting aside the four neighborhood squares and the center square was, as I suggest, a remarkable statement of community in laying down the city.
The original size was river to river, Delaware.
River to river from Vine to South Streets. Those aren't the original names of the streets, but Vine to South Street and the four squares that are today called Franklin, Washington, Rittenhouse, and Logan.
You subsequently note that you posit that the failure to set aside additional squares with growth in the city was one of the biggest missed opportunities.
It was. Penn's plan just was that narrow area. And if the city had set aside additional squares as it grew, it would have created neighborhood centers as the city expanded. Fairmount Park, which came later, is a wonderful asset to the city, really a jewel. But it's not where most of the people were, certainly not in the 19th century, which was more hugging the river. East abroad.
And here's where we get into class and economic divisions.
Right.
Those of lesser means had lesser ability than to get to the new Fairmount Park.
Absolutely. I mean, a trolley ride was a nickel each way, and that was a lot of money. And to walk from, you know, Kensington to the park could be done, but, you know, it wasn't like around the corner.
The tension between commerce and culture plays out from the beginning right to modern day. When Benjamin Franklin came on the scene in the beginning of the 18th century, he was very much the champion of developing culture.
Absolutely. And Franklin is an astonishing figure and spearhead in so many of the community assets of the 18th century, the fire company, the library company, the hospital, what became U of P. All of these things came out of Franklin's initiative. It ought to be Franklin on the top of City Hall and not Penn.
What was the heyday of Philadelphia?
That's a good question. Certainly, it was the nation's capital and the nation's largest city in the late 18th century. It was the financial capital. That's why the first bank of the United States was here, and the second bank later on. Although by the time the second bank was built, New York had kind of eclipsed it as a financial capital. In terms of industrial prowess, it would have been at the turn of the 20th century, but there were a lot of social problems, economic problems at that time. And in some ways, I'd say maybe the 20s to the 50s, when it was at the height of its size and resources, maybe that was the heyday. It's a difficult answer because how do you define, you know, what is its peak of importance?
Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Roger Simon, professor of history at Lehigh University and author of Philadelphia, A Brief History. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Our show tonight is history. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.